Okay, count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
We're interviewing John Skeff Sheehy, who was a member of both the State House of Representatives and the State Senate, and then a longtime justice on the Montana Supreme Court. And this interview is taking place on June 8th at Justice Sheehy's home in Helena. Justice Sheehy, thank you so much for the opportunity to interview you. What caused you, what motivated you, I should say, to become involved in politics? What did your interest in politics?
Well, I was raised in Butte, and because of that, I was very interested in politics all the way. My father was elected as county coroner in Butte, and from that, our family had political experience. But I was always interested in politics, even as a kid. Now, I was 13 years old probably, when Franklin Roosevelt came to Butte.
When was that, 36?
1931. He was elected in 32.
I see.
And well, it could have been in 19, it was in the campaign, so
32.
It might have been 32.
Yeah.
And there was a tremendous crowd there. They built a big platform out for him to speak at the courthouse. And now that there's been a lot of publicity lately about his crippled condition, and it's amazing to me that none of us realized in 1932 the extent of his disability. Somehow he appeared on the stage behind the rostrum. I suspect now he was almost lifted there, but he did have some agents with him, and they may have helped him. At any rate, that's what I look back and on. He electrified the crowd. He just took over. He was just such a sparkling personality.
Wow.
Yeah. But then, to your question, you couldn't live in Butte and not be interested in the courthouse, because the courthouse had jobs to offer for people in Butte, and those families, if they could elect one of their members, could get jobs in the courthouse. The spoils system was fully rampant, and everybody understood that. It didn't work out too badly. I think that because of that, though, right from the beginning, as a kid, I'd go to on election days, I'd go to the polling places and watch them count those paper ballots, and watch the way they tallied the votes in their books and so on. It was interesting. I'm always interested in it.
And your dad, of course, as you mentioned, was involved
in
politics.
Yes,
he probably knew other people who were too. So
he probably had
legislators and county commissioners and things in your home from time to time.
I was an admirer of Harry Freeborn. Harry Freeborn was elected county attorney in Butte, and later was an attorney general.
Okay.
And then
district judge at one time, wasn't he?
No, and then his son was district judge.
I got you. Okay.
And Harry himself ran against Wheeler for the senatorship in 1940, I would say. And after that, he was on the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Now, Harry Freeborn, in 1932 in Butte, the same time that Freeborn was, Roosevelt was elected, There used to be a hotel in Butte on Broadway Street called the Butte Hotel. It had three or four stories, but at the end of the hallway, I assume, in the front of the building, there was a kind of a parapet, a little space where you could step out from a door and look down on the street below. And on the night before, or the weekend before the election, be Saturday or Sunday, the local politicians would come to that hotel and stand on that parapet on the second floor and speak out to the people gathered below in the street.
Huh.
And there'd be thousands of them.
Really?
That
was just a tradition. People knew that would happen.
Politics were interesting.
Sure.
We think back on that. There's no TV.
Sure.
Radio is just beginning to bloom. And it was kind of a form of entertainment. And those fellows, if you had seen Jerry O'Connell or Burton Wheeler or Harry Freeborn, to name some, speak, the way they could capture the crowd. It was just, it was great entertainment on top of being interesting too.
Describe Jerry O'Connell.
Jerry O'Connell is one of the most amazing persons that came to Montana politics, because he was raised in Butte, mother a widow. I think his mother washed floors somewhere to get him into school and through college. He was just a magnificent orator. And when he was 20 years old, he was elected to the Public Service Commission in Montana, and he had to wait until his birthday to take office because he still wasn't 21. Then he served in that position, I think, 4 years, and then he ran for the Congress in the Western District. And again, he had to wait. He was elected, he had to wait for a few months.
Before he was 25?
Before he take office, yes.
Did you ever meet him?
Oh, yes, yeah, oh, yeah. And then, as a congressman, he got into some trouble he was associating with people that may have been communists. You know, there was that allegation against him. Excuse me. But the biggest thing about Jerry O'Connell was that he divorced his wife and married somebody else.
And while he was a young congressman?
While he was in the Congress.
I see.
And while he could, he just couldn't get away with that with those Irish Catholics in Butte. And so he lost. He didn't lose in the primary, though. I had people run. In fact, Mike Mansfield ran against him. No, Mike Mansfield may have run against him. I'm not clear on that now. But Jerry got the nomination, but he lost to the lady.
Was it Jeanette Rankin?
Jeanette Rankin, yeah.
Okay.
She's the one who beat him. Yeah. So you had a situation where this man at 20 was kind of the golden boy of politics, and by the time he was 30, was all through.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing. And more than that, afterwards he came to Great Falls and practiced law in Great Falls with Gene Daly. They were related through marriage in some way. And my partner, Jack Shields, down in Billings, had come to Helena one time to on the Supreme Court and happened to overhear Jerry O'Connell make an oration, I should call it an oration, and make an argument to the Supreme Court. He wanted to get off a man who was convicted of murder. He was a hitchhiker, he had killed somebody up in Shelby. This particular man did, and he was sentenced to hang. But his speech to the court either got him a new trial, or at any rate, the hanging didn't occur. And when Jack Shields came back to Billy, he never heard anybody like that. He said, "It's just the most amazing man I've ever heard."
Effective oratory?
He was just tremendous. Yeah, he was very effective. And in those days, as I described, we didn't have TV and so on. So,
when did he go to law school?
He didn't go to law school. He went to the Carroll College and graduated from Carroll College.
Well, how did he get to be a lawyer?
I don't know. You asked a pretty good question.
He may have been back in Congress or something.
You see, in those days also, all you had to do is take the test.
I see.
You didn't have to have a college degree. In fact, I knew several lawyers when I went to Billings who had started out as secretaries to lawyers,
yeah,
and took those correspondence courses and got their law degree and took the test.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you where he got his law degree, but it wasn't. He did go to Carroll College. That's where he graduated from. I want to describe to you also that what all these politicians did. In the summertime in Butte, you would have picnics, especially the unions would have picnics. June 13 of every year was Labor Union Day, Miners Union Day, and there was always a big picnic. And then you'd have Labor Day, and and July the 4th. There were lots of reasons to have picnics, and they'd like the butcher's union would supply the meat. We'd all get free hamburgers, free hot dogs. So we went to those political meetings, and the way they worked it, they were just beginning to utilize outdoor broadcasting. What do you call it? Make it possible for you to hear.
Yeah.
Public address systems were just coming in the early 30s, and they'd get up on the back of a truck, you know, on a flat base truck, and speak from there, and we'd all gather, all the people would gather around and listen to them, and they were just spectacular. They'd start out, you know, fully dressed, and pretty soon Jerry O'Connell especially would peel off his coat, and then people holler, "Warm up and go get him, Harry," or holler at him like they hollered at Harry Truman, "Go get him," or something like that. And he'd go on, and of course they were all against the ACM, so that was a big, and everybody was agreeing with him because they were in the middle of the Depression. Why? It was pretty tough living over in Butte, and they could mesmerize people.
Yeah.
They'd take off their coat, take off their ties, you know, roll up their sleeves, and talk for an hour and a half, and Wheeler could do it too. Wheeler did it.
Wheeler was also very effective
Just.
You remember Senator James Murray?
I do. Yeah.
He
wasn't that type.
He wasn't that type.
We worried about it. He talked too long.
Yeah.
As Democrats, someone always used to, we were sitting next to him at the table, and we'd say, pull him by the coattail and pull him down. He just couldn't stop talking once he started. And but he didn't seem to mind. He just went ahead and spoke.
Now, you mentioned that they all were against the Anaconda Company during that period of time. When you were a young person, you were obviously influenced by that very political climate. That there seems like, from the sound of things, your family was kind of political, but it was a politics and speech making was a sort of a form of entertainment and that sort of thing. How would you characterize the development of your political philosophy?
Well,
growing up where you did,
pretty easy. First of all, my father didn't become coroner until about 1938, I think it was, and by that time I'm 20 years old. In those early days, he was a hard rock miner, and he would work 6 days a week. He didn't have the 40-hour week. Payday was on Saturday, and you lived from Saturday to Saturday. I can tell you that in 1934, I would say, the miners had a strike. There was a strike about every 3 or 4 years, on top of the other problems they had. When the miners were in the 1934 strike, their wage for that day was $3.25 for an 8-hour day. And then they had their strike, and they won that strike in 34. And their pay was increased to $5.25 a day, with an agreement that whenever the price of copper raised a penny a pound, they'd get an additional 25 cents a day.
Huh, wow.
It tied to the price of copper. That was that particular strike. But in my early youth, we lived on North Montana Street, 621 North Montana Street. And right next to us was the BA and Butte Anaconda Pacific Railroad. That was a railroad that carried ore from the mines out to Anaconda and brought back lumber, coal, for the use of the mines for their timbering and so on, their supplies. And the train would run by our house about every 3 or 4 hours, all day long.
Wow.
It was a kind of an exciting place to be. But, you know, it was just so much activity and industrial activity. But in those hard times when there was no money around, very early in my life, I used to steal wood from the Anaconda Company. I'd go over to the mine yard. They had every mine was enclosed by a fence about 8 to 10 feet high, about the height of a basketball ring. And they painted red. I would climb that fence, get inside, and find them. We used to call them lagging. I don't know, laggins. They would be about 8 inches wide and 12 feet long and 2.5 inches in depth, and rough hewn. So I get those and heave them over the fence and then go back and get them and take them home. And then in 10 minutes, I'd have those split and stacked so that we could burn them. We didn't have natural gas, by the way.
Sure.
Yeah. That was before gas came to Butte in 1931. So early on, in order to supplement our living, that was one of the things I did. I was among several others of our neighborhood that do it. I look back on that now and realize that the company knew what was going on. Because they had watchmen in the mines, but nobody ever. They'd chase us if they saw us, but there was never any prosecutions that way. So I kind of think that those men who sat in the sixth floor of the Hennessy building over there, and they could look out and see us up at the Stewart Mine, for the love of Mike. So I'm sure that they knew the conditions and the reasons we were there and let it happen.
Yeah.
Well, there was that, and then there was a, you kind of divided much more than people are now by wealth. And the people who had good jobs with the company lived like barons. They had automobiles with chauffeurs. Their houses were supplied to them inside the man yard. The grass was cut in the summertime and painted and whatever. Huh. You know, it's hard to understand that now, but.
So it was a very classified system.
Oh, absolutely. Their kids would come to school, dropped off by the chauffeurs, you know. And it was just that kind of a situation.
Did you know those kids, too?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
How were they treated by the other kids?
Just like students, you know. But there was, you never did get to mix with them much, you know. Uh-huh. There was no doubt that there was one side and another side of it.
And I understand, I think, where you're coming from here, Skeff, but in terms of your political philosophy, I mean, life was a struggle for working class blue collar people in the mining city of Butte when you were a kid, and that obviously influenced political philosophy. Yeah. But how would you then describe your political philosophy as the result of those experiences?
Well, because of that, I was largely against the company, you know, and I believed in. I guess I didn't think about this when I was 13 or 14 years old, but when Roosevelt got going with his programs, boy, I supported those, especially the relief things that came along in 34 and 35, because, as I said, there was a strike around that time, and people in Butte got relief. They had to have relief. They'd have starved to death. I was telling you about Harry Freeborn. He was county attorney in Butte then, and by the way, I want to tell you, when he ran for office in 1932, he was speaking up there on that Butte Hotel, Bannister place, he would his platform running for county attorney was, well, first I got to explain that Anaconda Company had shut down its mines, so that they were working 2 days, 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. My father would work 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off for $3.25 a day. 6 days a week, about $20 a week. And then 2 weeks, and then he's off for 2 weeks. And all those miners had that. You're talking about, in 1939, there were 13,000 members of the miners union in Butte. So you're talking about a big economic problem in Butte in those days. And the companies said they couldn't work the mines any more than that because there was a surplus of copper in the United States, and in fact there were 50,000 tons of it, and that they just couldn't produce any more copper than they were producing. So Harry Freeborn, running for county attorney in Butte, speaking to the crowd down below, came out with his platform. He said that the Anaconda Company should throw those 50,000 tons of copper in the sea and start over And down below the people, yeah, you're right, Harry. It was a big, well, he won big, I mean, and he stayed in office. The other thing about him was that he was generous to the, you know, he gave a lot of money away. I know of families that got tons of coal from him and stuff like that.
Was Freeborn a man of some wealth?
No, that's the strange thing. He'd come out from, I think somewhere back in the Midwest, came to Montana as a miner and one of those guys that studied and got to be a lawyer.
Where did he get the money to buy the coal for the poor people?
Well, I have to give you, I wrote a thing about him once. Gambling was permitted there, you know, and I don't know. All I can tell you is that if he had any, if he collected it, he gave it away. You know,
I see.
Because he just was that kind of a
guy. He might have collected money from gamblers and then gave it away, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Gambling was illegal then. I'm just guessing. I don't want to say that as an averment because I have no direct proof of that.
Yeah.
I can tell you, though, that when he became Attorney General and was very popular, and the Wheeler people began to fear that he was going to run against them. And so they brought an action against him for, Wheeler was in the Senate then, and the United States District Attorney brought a criminal case against Freeborn, saying that he had taken $11,000 from the slot machine people so they'd have an exclusive kind of a slot machines around the state of Montana. That was the allegation. And when I got to say for Wellington Rankin, who was the other party, he had run for various offices himself, you know, on the Republican Party. And Harry Freeborn told me this when he was on the court one night when I met him in the Montana Club. He told me that Wellington Rankin called him up and said, "I'll defend you and it won't cost you a dime."
So, really?
Huh. Yeah. So he did defend him. And Freeborn was acquitted of that charge. And later then, Freeborn was on the Montana Supreme Court. And here is Mr. Wellington Rankin coming up once in a while with a case to argue. And Freeborn said to me, "You know, it all seems to me like Mr. Wellington is right."
Okay.
I've written that down. It's in the Historical Society.
Did you ever meet Wellington Rankin?
Yes.
Any impressions of him?
Oh, let me tell you, extraordinary man. Because where I really met him was I tried a case against him in Glasgow. It was a three-cornered case. He was suing my client. And let's see now. He was suing two different people, two defendants. I represented one of the defendants, and the guy who later became a judge also in Glasgow. I can't think of his name now. Anyway, he was representing the other, and the plaintiff was Wellington Rankin. And the thing about him was that he must have been, that would have been in, well, it was the weekend that Kennedy got killed.
So Rankin only lived a year or two after that.
I don't think he lived long after that because I think he was 80 years old at least when we tried that case. The thing I want to tell you about him, though, his voice, he could rattle the windows of that courthouse.
when he was 80 years old.
He had such a stentorian voice that he could really. And the upshot of that trial was that I won, but the other guy lost. So Rankin got a verdict of some kind there. But the thing about that case was that following, after the trial, we would go into meet in the judge's office up there, the district judge. His name was Dignan. And Dignan had been a judge only for a few years when we got there. He followed Judge Shea. And when he was very proud of the courthouse they had then. And one of the things he told us about was, this is Dignan speaking and telling Wellington Rankin. He said that in 1906 or so, there had been a man who was in jail. Someone got the gun away from the deputy and killed the deputy. And got out of jail and they caught him went down to the railroad station where he was hoping to catch a train and get out of town. So they brought him back to the courthouse, the local posse did, and took him up to that judge's chambers, and they tied a rope around his neck, and the other end around the radiators at the bottom of the window, and threw him out the window.
Wow.
Judge Dignan would say, and there's the radiator.
Wow.
I got to tell you one more story about that, because Rankin told one of his own. He said that he defended the farmers and around the Deer Lodge area who had lost cattle by reason of the emissions from the Anaconda smelter. He somehow or other, they tried that case in Fort Benton. How it got up there, I don't know, because it...
Yeah.
But I would think that the company didn't want to try it either in Anaconda or Butte, so they probably consented to Fort Benton. But when during the case, the company took the position that these cattle had died of pneumonia, and that it wasn't the emissions or sulfur emissions from the smelter. So, and to in the course of their proof, they would they had some experts, so called, who came out and testified that indeed these cattle had died of pneumonia. Rankin would ask them if they'd ever, at this time, ever isolated the pneumonia virus or whatever. And no, that hadn't been done yet, but no doubt they died of pneumonia. But along they had about six or seven of those, and finally brought one up to the stand who was testifying along the same line, except that Rankin asked him, had they yet isolated the pneumonia virus? And the guy said, yes. And Rankin said, could you go to the blackboard and draw a representation? And he hopped right up. Rankin said he hopped right up. The lawyers were shouting and trying to stop it. And the judge was kind of deaf. I guess he said, let him go. So the guy got up there and he drew on the backboard, and Rankin said, it looked like a grasshopper. So he said, the way he finished the story was, you know, he says, my parents came up to Fort Benton on the... on a barge. That's how they came to Montana, he said. And that's an important historical town for that reason. But he says, to me, the most important historical thing about it is that's the first time they ever isolated the pneumonia virus. And if anybody asks, it looks like a grasshopper. That was Rankin's story. But the other part of it was, he said that night, he was kidding with the anaconda. They all were in the Fort Union, Grand Union Hotel up there in Fort Benton. And I think one of them, his name was Dwyer, one of his lawyers for the company. Anyway, when they were talking about it, he said to, the lawyer said to Rankin, Wellington, every lawyer ought to come into court with a revolver. And when a witness like that blows up on you, shoot the son of a bitch and call the next witness. That was Rankin's story. And I really enjoyed him, and I think he had a kind of respect for me, too. I mean, I appreciated that. Yeah. Well, coming back, my philosophy didn't... it was just that way. Everybody in Butte was a Democrat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
it was because it was basically the working class people against
And then we did have on the national scene as commanding characters like Roosevelt.
Yeah. Skip, do you have back in that period of time, I know this was before you were actively involved in politics yourself, but you mentioned your impressions of Harry Freeborn and of Jerry O'Connell. Are there any other people I'm thinking perhaps of Governor Bonner or Governor Ford, Mansfield?
I never really had any direct contact with Burton Wheeler. I listened to him as a kid, but I never ever, I suppose I met him, but I have no recollection. John Bonner was related to everybody in Butte. They were the Bonners and the Lynches and the Hinches and the Clinches. all first cousins of his, not to mention the Fitzgeralds and the Kellys. So, and he himself was a very, very nice way about him. He got into that thing in New Orleans, you know, and that ruined him, but he later served on the Montana Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And he was a capable man, too. He had a great war record. He went to he left the Attorney General's office and went to war in World War II. And came back, I think, some high office. But he served one term.
Yeah.
Art Lamy I knew well.
Art Lamy was a lawyer from Billings, right?
Yeah. Well,
was he Attorney General? Or
no, what? No. Art Lamy was raised in Havre. And in his young days, he got polio and was crippled, really crippled. But like Roosevelt. He had 25 pounds of things to stand up on. And he was very active in the Democratic Party up in Havre, and then ran for governor and lost in the Democratic primary to Roy Ayers. And in fact, the year that Roy Ayers wanted to be reelected, the Democrats wanted to get rid of him for some reason or other, and that is some Democrats like Tom Stout and some fairly responsible people, and they put Art Lamy up and he lost, but then he moved.
Ford
beat Ayers. Yeah, 1940.
Yeah. 1940. Yes.
Yeah. Then Lamy moved down to Billings, and he joined the name of the firm was Coleman, Jameson, and Lamy. That's the Crowley firm that you hear about now. They formed that firm and prospered. But Art Lamy, his office is above mine in the electric building down there. So I saw him a lot and visited a lot with him. He was an amazingly good-looking man. Boy, he was a handsome man. Virile face, you know. Great storyteller too.
Uh-huh.
So he was quite a wonderful guy. He ran again. He ran against Bonner, but couldn't get the nomination. And then Bonner lost.
Yeah.
Well,
he's come up in other interviews, so he's made quite an impression on a fair number of people. Arthur Lamy.
He was, you'd realize, you know, he's a very handsome guy. And not only handsome, but smart and polished. And someone appointed him to. He was some kind of a delegate to the United Nations.
I see. Okay.
From Montana.
Yeah.
Mike Mansfield may have done
that.
No, Mike Mansfield. So you're working in his center, is that
yes,
it?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I first met him. Let me how to. I went to the University of Montana. How I got there, another story, but I went to the University of Montana in 1936 and took journalism. And one of the courses, the survey courses we had was social science. And the way they worked in those days, there were about 200 of us in that freshman class, would go to a lecture hall and hear a talk from somebody, and then they'd partition off in sections, and I happened to wind up in the section that was taught by Mike Mansfield. So maybe that's when some of my political philosophy came there, because Mike, a very straight-thinking kind of a guy, and really impressed the students. One of the reasons for his popularity was that he knew all those students, and he never forgot a name, and he never forgot a face. You could surprise him, and he'd say hello to you, and name you, give you, say hello, John, or whatever. So that, and also then, well, I had that class from him, and then I was out of school for a year. I went 2 years at the School of Mines, and then came back. I had to get enough credits to get to law school, and I came back to the university, and I was president of the Newman Club, which was a Catholic college group, and he was our faculty advisor. And so when he decided to run for a Congress then, he came to Butte and looked up all his old students. I was one of them, and had a lot of contact with him over the years after that. But he was another one.
How would you describe him, if you could describe him in a, you know, like in a paragraph? How would you describe him? Is he an easy person to sum up in an easy description?
Not really, except to say that there was always a little bit of aloofness about him. You knew that this guy was a very intellectual, a man of great intellect, and that he was focusing on some big things all the time. That he wanted to... he didn't want to have people too close to him, because I think he didn't want to be in a situation where he'd have to say yes or no to something that maybe he wouldn't agree with. So he had that aloofness, which he exercised, as far as the Democrats are concerned, to the point that we used to say he'd come to town and call up Joe Sample and Billings, who ran the television station, and then go out of town again. We never knew he was there. And we'd like to know, have him, because Mike Mansfield had a dinner, you immediately could sell 100 tickets.
Did it surprise you that he was the Senate Majority Leader, and for as long as he was?
In some way, yeah. No, not as long. Mike Mansfield also had some tricks of fate that helped him. When Kennedy ran in 1960, I was very active in the Kennedy thing. In fact, I'm the first guy in Montana that Ted Kennedy met. They told me he was coming out to Billings, and would I go pick him up? And I said, "How will I know him?" And they said, "When you see him, you'll know him."
Because he looks so much like John Kennedy.
Oh no, not at all. He was very virile kind of a guy. Yeah. Kennedy was straight and kind of like Mike Mansfield, you know, very austere kind of.
John Kennedy was.
Yeah, yeah. That's my impression. But Mike Mansfield, Senator Johnson, old
LBJ.
LBJ was the majority leader. And Mike was his whip. And so when LBJ decided to run, Mike was for him. You know, Mike, almost by circumstance, had to be for him. And so Mike came out to, we had the Democratic Convention in Helena that summer. Do you know that we had... L.B. Johnson, L.B.J., and Hubert Humphrey, and the guy who was the Veep, and the Simontons from
Missouri. Yeah.
All here in Helena, Montana, looking for our 17 votes.
Oh, wow.
That was how close that race was shaping up before the Los Angeles Convention. And so when Mike came here, myself and Tom Hanrahan and Pat Williams had cornered all the votes.
for John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, for Kennedy. And the result was that Mike Mansfield got his own vote and two others. One of them, Metcalf, the two Democrats, each of them being entitled to one vote. And a couple of others. We had 14, he had 17. That's what I remember about it, for out of the Montana delegation.
Kennedy had how many votes?
We had 14 of the Montana, out of the 17.
Out of the 17, yeah. I see. Wow. Well,
and Mike got 17.
Mike got four.
Three, excuse me.
Yeah, three or four.
Yeah. Out of that, the coolest that I never was able to.
Well, that's
ameliorate, you know. you had to admire the guy. I remember listening on TV one time when that Everett Dirksen from stood up and whatever was going on in the Senate. He just said to Mike, he said, "Mike, we love you." I think it was because Mike was so fair to everybody. He just didn't, he gave everybody a chance, and I think that they were satisfied. He led the party well and didn't override other people or cause them any embarrassment, which is a secret of being there that long.
Did you meet Senator Metcalf?
Yes, very well, yeah.
What are your impressions?
Well, he was another intellect, very, he was a difficult man because his problem of alcoholism. He could have been just a tremendous man except for that problem.
He was volatile, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, very volatile, yeah.
Did you ever see an example of that?
Yeah. I took him over to, he was in Billings one time eating at a restaurant, sitting in a booth, you know, and I had a friend in Billings named Bob Zepp who wanted to meet him. So I took Bob over and said, "Senator, this is Bob Zepp," and then I said, "I guess they changed our meeting date. It was going to be one place, they changed to another that day, our Democratic meeting." And I said, "It's going to be up at the Eastern," I think it was. And he said, and he got mad, and he just raised, heck, you know, and I had nothing to do with the changing of that. So, and I was pretty mad about it myself, because I walked away, and Zepp said to me, "Babcock's looking better all the time, wasn't he?"
That must have been 1966,
yeah,
when you were running against the
right,
U.S. Senate.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that was one example. Then that night at the meeting, he apologized publicly to me for having lost his temper, but he should never have lost his temper with me, you know.
Yeah.
Never. But I think that he also was maybe too focused on, he was just tied up too much on one thing. He's anti power company, and he just couldn't get over it. And eventually that hurt him.
Do you know what the basis for that was? Had he had some of a bad experience with him?
I don't know. He was in the, as a young man, he was in the legislature. He served in the legislature. And I think one of the youngest men ever elected to the Supreme Court. Well, he and Leif Erickson would be vying for that honor.
Yeah.
I do remember when his campaign, when the radio campaign was, Lucky Strike was advertising that time, Lucky Strike Mighty Fine Tobacco, they said LSMFT, they'd use that acronym, and he came on with the acronym LM. Mighty Fine Kennedy, MFC. He sounded like a stripe, but it was Lee Metcalf.
Lee Metcalf, yeah.
It was a clever,
clever
radio ad, yeah. And I think it helped get him elected, because his elections were all close, really close.
You first ran for the state legislature in 1958.
58, yeah.
What motivated you to run?
I don't know. I had been, when I first got to Billings, I married to a Republican, my partner, Jack Shills, Rita's brother, is a Republican. He served two terms as a Republican from Billings. And when I was a Democrat and I was a chairman of the Yellowstone Democratic County Committee down there at that time, and somewhere along the line, I just decided to throw my hat in the ring. And I remember the first time I ran, I put an ad in the paper that said, this ad has cost me $110 or whatever it was, and that's all I'm going to spend. I hope you'll vote for me. And that worked, I guess. Because in that race, I beat Batten, Jerry Anderson, Babcock. I read a whole bunch of them.
Ran ahead of all of them.
A Democrat.
Yeah, wow.
A Democrat running
from Billings.
From Billings.
Unusual, because yeah. That was a real Republican stronghold.
Oh, the straight eight. Yeah, so I beat him that time. Then we came up here and had that session. You were talking about PUDs. That wasn't such a big issue with me.
Now, public utility districts, yeah. I think, is what they were called.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that was a hot issue. The Montana Power Company was intensively involved in that in 1959.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you remember anything about it?
Yeah. I was up here just a short time when that came up. And I didn't know much about public utility districts, but Art Lamey, my friend Art Lamey, came up and talked to me one night, and I said to him, well, I'll vote with you. I won't speak on the thing, but I'll vote with you. And that's what I did.
What was Lamey's position?
Well, he was working for the power company.
Oh, I see.
That firm was representing the power company.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
And for him, and yeah. My supporter.
I see.
But I didn't have any feeling one way or the other about public utility districts.
Now, in that session, of course, two future governors in that 1959 yeah. session, Tim Babcock and Ted Swindon.
Yeah.
What about them do you remember as legislators?
Babcock, not so much. You know, he wasn't that forceful in the legislature. What was, although he later. He really grew in office. He became kind of a strong candidate, I thought. But in those days, you see, Nutter was the big push, and to tie down the Billings vote, they took in Babcock as his lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
And then of course, Nutter got killed, and Babcock came on the scene, and then. He took over for that. But Ted Swindon
yeah.
was a teacher and a very good talker. You know, his seat was way back in the back of the house, and he was very forceful when he stood up. And of course, his big thing was the farmers, looking out for them, and did a good job of it, and also education. Because he was a teacher.
Would you have predicted that he might someday become governor?
No, not then. I'd kind of wasn't thinking about those things.
Yeah, sure.
Know? Yeah. I think that when he became lieutenant governor under Judge, wasn't it?
Yes.
I was surprised when he decided to run. You know, because, he decided to run. But, Judge had gone past his time, really. I can see what he was thinking. In fact, Mrs. Judge, Tom Judge's mother,
Blanche,
I talked to her before that decision came out. And she said to me, I don't want him to run. She said, I don't want him to run. She had a feeling.
Now, you served with Tom Judge in the Senate.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What are your impressions?
A young man, up and going, you know, he's big on the environment. He was pushing that. Clean Water Act that was so big with him, and I think was the basis of his eventual success because he did such a good job of it. He was a young man on the go.
And yeah. You might more have predicted that he might someday run for governor.
Oh yeah, yeah. We knew he was going to run for.
Yeah,
yeah. Knew he was going to run for governor.
Now, Skip, the Anaconda Company, of course, had been a powerful part of your boyhood when you were in Butte. And your impressions of the Anaconda Company importantly affected your political philosophy. they were, I think, maybe somewhat in decline as your legislative career began, but they were still pretty
powerful.
Oh, not
in 58.
They were still a pretty powerful.
Not in 59, yeah. 10 years later, they were in decline.
Well, then talk about your impressions of them in 1959 and early on.
Well, they are very strong presence in the legislature. They had that watering hole.
Were you ever there?
Well, I was a couple of times.
In fact, describe that.
What they had was two rooms in the Placer Hotel, on 5th or 6th floor, one or the other. And they had a layout of food on the table where you could make sandwiches and so on, and people to help you make sandwiches. And lots of booze if you wanted that. And but they had a rule among themselves, no lobbying. And their idea was that they're not going to lobby anybody in that water hole. And they didn't. And they didn't allow the participants to lobby other people at the same time. That was off limits. And the effect of that was that they could ingratiate themselves very nicely. And really, they were very friendly guys, you know, those lobbyists. You know. I think that Billy Ray and his partner...
Lloyd Crippen?
No, well, Lloyd was the son-in-law of Billy Ray, but...
Denny Shea?
Denny Shea, well, I can tell you about him, but... no, the other guy, he went back to Washington. Wilkinson.
Al Wilkinson. Yeah.
He was a polished man, that man. I think the best lobbyist we ever had around Montana. At any rate...
what was the key to his being such a good lobbyist?
He was knowledgeable, he knew what he was doing, and he knew when to push and when not to push. You know, it never bothered me. And they soon realized that I was first for labor and then for business. And so they let me alone. They never lobbied me. Denny Shea, he came along, I guess that might have been his first time in 59, I'm not sure. Might have been 65 when he first arrived. But at any rate, I knew him from, he was down the street from me, he was raised on Boardman Street.
In Butte.
Yeah. Matter of fact, his mother came to my mother, and their house they lived in had an outhouse. Didn't have a inside plumbing. And I was lying around in Butte. She wondered if I would come down there and help him get that. I dug a trench from that house out to the sewer line and installed a sewer outside the sewer line in their house.
Well, that should have made him do some favors for you in the legislature.
Then. He came to me and offered me, right at the first day, he said, I'm going to put a quart of booze in your locker. And I said, Jenny, don't do it. I don't drink it. I don't need it. But he never, ever attempted to talk to me anyway. Eventually, Glenn Carney came to me one time, and this was in the Senate. And he told me that the corporation was having problems because these corporate raiders were going around and raiding the directors, the boards of directors of these various companies. And Anaconda Company was really a possibility in that. And they had moved their their corporate headquarters to Montana. And would I push a bill for them, which I did, that you had to have, you couldn't oust, for any corporation in Montana that had more than 25,000 stockholders, it protected the board of directors. You couldn't get them out with a single vote, you know.
Yeah, which would only really have described the
Anaconda. And the power company.
In Montana.
Yeah. So we got that through for them. Yeah. And that was toward the end of the session. And I think that's the only time that the Anaconda people ever asked me directly to help them out.
So, from what I hear you say, is you didn't really see the heavy hand of the Anaconda Company.
Oh, they let me alone.
Did they seem to be a controlling influence?
Oh, very much so. They were, yeah.
How?
I don't know how they... Well, let me tell you in my own experience. I think that when the people come to the legislature and they begin to, they take their positions, here they are coming in from outside places, some of them never been in government before, and very early in the session they fix on somebody they're going to follow. I think that whenever I was in the sessions, I had 10 votes I could count on any time. They watch where I voted and follow. And I think that's a part of the legislature, that some people are kind of recognized as maybe they know what it's all about, and and it's safer to go with them. And that's what they do.
So you had some people who tended to follow your...
There's any doubt, yeah.
Say again?
But there isn't any doubt.
But but how did that relate that back to the Anaconda companies?
Oh, well, they had certain people too that
okay.
They would follow the same way, you know. There are a lot of sheep in the legislature.
Yes.
And they fix on somebody, and whatever he does, the party line is important, of course.
So what you're saying is...
Within each party, you've got people who can call on votes that they know they're going to get, whichever way they vote.
Well, sure, but what you're saying is the Anaconda Company may have identified some key leaders and kind of worked with them?
I'm sure they did.
So that they didn't lobby so many people individually.
Yeah.
But they tended to lobby...
You know, they all stayed at the Plaza Hotel.
Yeah.
And signed the checks down there. I mean, they put it on the tab, but that tab was taken care of eventually. That's my suspicion.
Yeah.
I was going to say one other thing about... Oh, well.
The Montana Power Company, any impressions of them during that same period?
Well, that's where Al Wilkinson really was. He was Anaconda Company.
Yeah.
Oh, it was Bob Corrett.
Bob
Corrett, another good guy, you know. I'm telling you, they never bothered me. They felt I knew what I was going to do. Now, I would be for labor. That's all there is to it. And then business would follow that. Being for labor, you'd be for education. All those things follow from that.
You went on then to serve on the Supreme Court. Were you appointed first, or did you just run?
Appointed.
Like, well, Governor Anderson?
No, Governor Judge.
Oh, Governor Judge, okay.
Yeah. Let me think about that for a second. In my career, I was, at 27 years of age, Chief Deputy Insurance Commissioner of the state of Montana for 2 years, and then another year I was Chief Deputy Securities Commissioner. Then I went down to Billings, and I ran for the legislature. I served in the House, and then served in the Senate, and then served on the Montana Supreme Court. The only person I can name who has served in every branch of the state government is myself and Gene Turnage. Gene Turnage was a county attorney. Half his salary was paid by the state in those days.
Yeah.
And so he has that same...
Okay. Well, Forrest Anderson.
Huh? Well, Forrest Anderson.
I think he would be, wouldn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Forrest Anderson would be, and there's one other. That guy who was governor in about 1928-29 and then came down to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I can't think of his name.
Oh, now. Sam Stewart.
That's the man. Yeah, that's the man. Yeah.
Now,
not many of us.
Not many.
Skip, I mean, in every house. See.
Do you have any impressions of Governor Anderson?
Governor, yeah.
Forrest Anderson?
Forrest Anderson. Ego man, you know, completely wrapped up in himself. And when I ran for Attorney General, he was mad at Rita. No help. You know, Rita had been chairman of the health committee, what do they call it, the American, Montana Medic, no. The Board of Health, Montana Board of Health. Rita was chairman of that.
Your wife Rita was.
Yeah, Governor Anderson appointed her. And then she was strong on environment and pushed a lot of those things through that they eventually were able to get out of it. There was first, and Forrest didn't like that. And in fact, there was a time when, you remember when the kids were going around with signs saying, keep Anderson Green or something like that. Huh. Keep Forrest Green. Well,
Forrest Green.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they felt that he wasn't supportive enough. Yeah. Those people from Missoula in those days, you know, yeah. they were really, and with good reason, worried about their health because of the
yeah.
Bad air. And clean water was part of that. So
you went on the Supreme Court, appointed by Governor Judge.
Judge.
And served on the Supreme Court how long?
12 years, 12 and a half years.
And there were, that was from when until when?
From April of 78 through the beginning of 90, first Monday of 99, excuse me, 91.
Okay.
Yeah.
Long period of time, late 70s all the way through the 80s.
12 and a half years, yeah. Uh-huh.
And a fair amount of important things happened then. Are there some court cases or some opinions or things that you feel are especially noteworthy that you were involved in during that period of time?
Well, I got to say this and without appearing to be bragging, but in all that period of time, every year I wrote more majority opinions than any other judge on the court. And more than that, I wrote more dissents than any other judge on the court.
Well, that sounds like you were a pretty hard-working justice then.
Well, I worked at it, and it came easy to me because I'd had 30 years of law practice, you know, trial work all the time. In the 60s, I tried more cases in Billings than any lawyer there. I just had a vast experience of trial experience. Gene Turnage and I think I tried his, I was with him on his first civil case.
Really?
Yeah. He was county attorney.
Huh.
And I represented the insurance company for that county. They had some kind of a truck accident or something. And
huh.
Together we worked on that case. I think that was his first civil case.
Really?
Yeah. We tried it in front of Judge Bezanson from Missoula,
huh.
who was kind of a funny guy. Coming up Thanksgiving, and he didn't want to let the ladies on the jury off to go home and cook the turkey. He would do it. They had to talk to him, the court officials, I think, talk the judge into postponing the trial until the following Monday. He wasn't going to do it. And Gene was on that case.
He was a great guy.
Yeah.
Well, are there cases, some that might pop into your mind that might be especially significant during the period of time that you were
on the court?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to pick them out because, except that one case, the case involving the 30% coal tax.
Okay.
That case was important to Montana, I thought, because when you take the coal out, unless you got something coming back to take the place of that, to be an asset, and we all lose. And the idea of, and they originally started out that they would take 30% tax and at the moment of severance of the coal from the ground, and then put that in an inviolable trust fund was just a perfect way to balance off the loss of that great asset, the coal.
Yeah.
And provide for a lot of things that we need in the future. So that 30% tax was important, and that was attacked, of course, by coal companies from the East, Consolidated, Edison, and so on. And the Supreme Court, Judge Malloy, held against, or for the tax, M-E-L-O-Y.
Yeah.
And then the case came to us, and I was assigned the case. And I put in, I decided that I'd put in a little schmaltz in that opinion. Because schmaltz sells, you know.
Uh-huh.
And you'll find a paragraph in there that says that Montanans are quite getting used to the fact that what happens when the when the mines deplete, when the mines run out, the oil depletes and the timber saws come still. I put that paragraph in there, it had nothing to do with it. But I think it swayed the Supreme Court because the United States Supreme Court upheld that 30% tax.
Yeah.
It wouldn't happen today. In fact, since then, they have said that that was an aberrant decision.
The U.S. Supreme Court has?
Yeah, that violates the Commerce Clause.
Oh, I see.
Because of the effect it had on interstate commerce. But I do think that our opinion was one that they couldn't, it was going to be very hard for them to say no to, and they didn't.
How about the school equalization?
Yeah, that was Barton, Bartness, or Fred Weber wrote that, but yeah. I was in full accord with that. That was an important case, and has repercussions going on today. You know, the idea that every child is entitled to the best kind of an opportunity you can get, and that's an important principle.
But you wrote the one that affirmed Judge Malloy.
Yeah, that's it. Tax case.
Give me another example of something that you maybe wrote that you were really involved in directly.
Huh. You know, I can't think of a single case that would be that had that.
Any criminal cases or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, I had. On criminal cases, yeah. I started out, the first case I got was that McKenzie case from Kalispell.
That was a capital case. Huh?
Capital case. Yeah. Death penalty. And then I got the Coleman case. And each of those cases, I upheld the death penalty.
You wrote the opinions on both of them?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then in the, there was one case in Kalispell, I can't remember the name of it now, where I disagreed and sent it back, and there was a lot of county attorney reaction to that. But eventually I came to the idea that I just couldn't stand it anymore. I don't like the death penalty and I don't want it to, I can't stand it. And as I was reading on these other cases and following up on that, came to understand the unfairness of it because it's not very well administered. Well, that has come out now in the past few years, there's so many. But the thing that influenced me mostly was Justice Brennan's
the U.S. Supreme Court.
U.S. Supreme Court opinion where he descended to a death penalty. And the reasons he gave all made sense to me. So the last several times then that the cases would come up to me, I would say I'm not going to vote anymore for a death penalty. So acted.
Now,
there was one case involving two Indian boys from Miles City, and their names, I don't remember their names now, something like Little Light, but that's not quite right. At any rate, they had been convicted. There were three of them had inveigled a woman and two boys. Had to inveigle a man out of the bar.
Echemendi. Yeah.
But I killed him in Wyoming.
Yeah.
That woman was the smartest woman that I ever read a transcript about. She was a finagler from the word go. And she, the bull was in her name, I can't remember what it was. At any rate, she testified against her friends and she had actually participated in the killing. And one of these boys was not there when the killing occurred down in Wyoming. But she participated in it and then was smarter than these fellows by a long ways. And they both were given the death penalty. And so I wrote a long dissent in that case saying that, pointing out that she had been a participant. It was so unfair for her to get away with this and not... And these boys would be dying. Well, what happened was that the case went down to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and while it was pending down there, the discovery was made that while she was in jail, she was having sex with the jailer. And that was, the county attorney knew about it and didn't reveal it to the defense. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court set aside the death penalty and gave them a life sentence down there. They didn't send it back for a new trial. They gave each one of them life, and that was the end of that.
So you were sort of upheld by the Ninth Circuit
Court? I sure was, yeah.
Now, we've got just a few minutes left.
Yeah, go ahead.
Justice Sheehy, and I remember you and I have something in common. There was a young lady, when I was Secretary of State, there was a young lady by the name of Janice Franquino Doggett, who was the lawyer for the Secretary of State's office, and she also served as your clerk when you were Associate Justice.
Yeah.
And a rather bizarre incident occurred when a man, you're just holding up a newspaper article to me, man menaces judge with loaded handgun. Tell us about that story.
Well, this was in June 24, would have been, of 1983. What happened was that this man was an architect who was employed by a Bozeman firm, and he had left the firm and taken with him some of the plans that he had drawn up while he was a member of the firm. The firm sued him to get him back, saying that that was their property and they wanted it. District Court upheld the firm, and I wrote the opinion upholding the firm that he had to surrender those plans. And their theory was that the creative part of his plans was his property, not the employer's. But that's not the law. So after the decision went down, on this particular day in June, I looked up at my desk, and there's a guy standing in front of me with a gun.
With a gun pointed right at him.
Yeah. And
how did he get in?
I gave a little squeal. He just walked in. I never locked my doors. Doors were always open. So, I gave a little squeal, but then, and then he said, I want you to call the television people to get out of here because I want to talk about my case. Well, my telephone, as you can see, was behind me there. So I turned around and was going to make the phone call for him, and then I turned around back to him and says, you know, if I make that telephone call, you're going to be in a whole lot of trouble. You ought to stop it now, something like that.
Yeah.
And for one thing led to another, we talked and talked and talked, and he was about his case and telling me about his family and all that stuff. And
he still got the gun pointed at
him. And he sat down in this chair, and he had the gun in his right hand. And you see the bandit, the railing on that side?
Yeah.
The same thing on the other side, that was sitting there. So that when Janice's office was down down that way, she could see him sitting there and me talking to him. And so she just went into her office and closed the door.
She had no idea what was going on.
No.
Yeah.
So we talked for about 45 minutes, and eventually I said to him, you know, come to realize that we're going to have to call the police and get it over with. And I said, I want you to put that gun in my drawer and put it there, and then we'll call the police. So I said, I'm not going to put it there, you put it there. And so he came over, I opened the drawer, and he put it in there.
You didn't give him the opportunity to just say, look, you walk out of here, and we'll forget the whole thing?
Oh, at the start, I told him, get out, why don't you get... I didn't say you forget the whole thing.
Yeah.
I said, you can get out of here. You'd be like, I want him to get out of there.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, I put my foot up against that drawer while I was sitting there, you know, so... And then I called the police. Well, while I was there...
Well, how did you talk him out of this whole thing?
I don't know. I just kept talking, you know.
How long did
he
take?
He wanted to talk. 45 minutes, I'd say. Yeah.
And he seemed satisfied after he'd gotten this off his chest?
No, he wasn't satisfied. What happened later, this is what the rest of the story, and the rest of the story. He was arrested and taken down to Helena here. And a couple of days later, I got a phone call from a woman in the Midwest somewhere who told me that she was his sister, and that they think that he was, you know, having a little bit of mental problems, and that one of the how bad the situation was. The more I talked to her, the more I realized. And she said that if she could get him back, that she'd be glad to take care of him. She'd come and get him and take care of him. So, but while she was talking to me, she told me that they had an uncle that had the same kind of experience. And I think he had invented Pyrex and got nothing out of it. For
his uncle invented Pyrex?
That's what I think. Got nothing out of
it?
Yeah.
And they've been mad about it ever since.
Well, he got probably a good salary and all that stuff, but he didn't get wealthy as he thought he should have. And yeah, that was a family sore point. At any rate, when the time came for his sentencing, Lobel, I wasn't there, Lobel called me up. And
local said, District Judge Henry
yeah,
Lobel.
Yeah, Judge Henry Lobel. And I said, I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to go to jail. Whatever my fright was at the start, it was pretty soon I was, you know, it was just, we were just talking. So Lobel, I think he put him on probation or something. His sister got him, took him back.
But still, this guy came into the office, not necessarily to shoot you, but to intimidate you with the gun into giving him a chance to talk before television cameras.
Let me say about that. When that situation comes about, when somebody comes in with a gun, the thing is really kind of out of his control. And whatever happens next is going to be very important. Like this case we had about that woman, that man had killed already two or three people and had her cornered here a couple of months ago. And she got to talking to him. And see that...
Down in Florida.
Down in Florida, yeah. What I'm trying to demonstrate is that the first few moments are important. It could be a tragedy, you know, if I went after him or something or tried to run or something, he might shoot me. But it's just a matter of luck.
Yeah.
Not luck exactly. The circumstances are out of his control. You just got to hope it'll work out.
And somehow you engaged him in conversation.
Yeah.
Because, he didn't get to talk to the television cameras.
No,
and he ended up having to go to jail. So it was the worst of everything for him.
Yeah, that's right.
And it makes you wonder why he didn't say, well, hell no, I'm not going to give you this gun. I'm walking out of here now.
Well,
and, you know,
I said to Janice afterwards, I said, what did you think was going on? See, he's sitting there with the child. She can see this guy talking to me. And she said, well, I know. She said, I thought you were talking about religion. I guess maybe I did say something about that along the way.
But he went, he agreed to allowing to call the police.
Uh-huh. He put the gun in my drawer.
He agreed to put the gun in your drawer and agreed to allow you to call the police.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, you're a pretty persuasive guy, I think.
It was important.
Yeah.
I got to tell you one other thing about that. While we were waiting for the police, into my office comes a friend from Butte named Pooch Fearon and his brother. You might have known Joe Fearon. He was at St. Ignatius. He was the undertaker up there for years.
Okay.
Joe Fearon and the two of their boys came in to see me. And we were waiting for the police to come. And they barely got in the office when the police did come. And they come, they take the gun out of my drawer and so on, and it goes on. And so they're witnessed. We visited very shortly, not very long. And they go down to Butte. The next day, this thing was in the paper. And Pooch was mad. He says, they didn't have our names in there at all.
What a story.
Yeah.
Well, Justice Sheehy, we've just got two or three minutes left. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion or anything about your wonderful career in public service spanning several decades in the legislature and as a Supreme Court Justice?
I'm very blessed in my life and all the things that have happened and not happened. And we have 11 children, and they're all seeming to be getting along pretty well now. And I'm just thankful every day that I've been given such a wonderful, long life. Now I've got to ask you a question off the record.
Yeah, can we turn it off?
Mm-hmm.